Good afternoon. Senate Judiciary Committee meeting is called to order. Today is Wednesday, February 16th, 2022. The time is 1:32 in the afternoon. We're meeting in State Capitol Room number 205. A full house today. Senators in attendance are Senator Keel, Senator Schauer, Senator Hughes, Senator Myers, and myself as chair, Senator Holland. We do have a quorum to conduct business today. Thank you. I forgot to write it down. Thank you to Nancy, our recording secretary, and Lydia, our moderator for today. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones if you have them on board. All right, first up is Senate Bill 182 before the committee. Senate Bill 182 is related to interference with emergency services. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 182. Senator Wilson, would you please come up to the presenter's table and bring along any staff you may need? While they're getting set up, I'll just announce we're following Senate protocols for masks, and so we are allowed to unmask when we're in our positions. Presenters, when they're at the table, are welcome to unmask. When in the Senate, when we get up and move around, we bring our mask with us, remask. But all right, so Senator Wilson, please introduce yourself and your staff, and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senate Judiciary Committee. For the record, I'm Senator David Wilson, Senate District D, Wasilla, Big Lake, Meadow Lakes area. And with me today is my trusty aide, Ms. Jasmine Martin. This legislation, Senate Bill 182, seeks to resolve a problem that was brought by our attention from members of our community and from the dispatch community. Senate Bill 182 establishes an offense with interference of emergency communications. Emergency communications, also known as 911. The misuse and abuse and disruption of 911 dispatch centers is a problem that impacts the delays of response of real emergencies. In the past, law enforcement has attempted to use other statutes such as harassment, false reporting, and disorderly conduct to stop the interference when this occurs. Often these efforts are dismissed by prosecuting attorneys because of the ambiguity of the statutes. What we're trying to do is, with SB 182, clarify some of these issues that that the dispatch community has seen with the problems of, and you'll hear later on from some of our invited testifiers. We have experts here in the field that can provide these real life examples of why this bill is needed to help provide real life saving emergency services to real 911 calls. This bill has support of many effective agencies around the community, such as Alaska Association of Police Chiefs, Alaska Anchorage PD, the Mat-Su Borough, and many others. I'll turn this over now, Mr. Chair, if you would like to have a sectional analysis by Ms. Martin.
Please proceed.
Thank you. For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Section 1, this is all new language. So Section 1 adds a new section to AS 1156. And so the first part of this establishes what the crime of interference with emergency communications are. So it's when a person calls 911 to report something that they've already reported and they've been told to stop calling, or if they call 911 when there's no emergency, if they threaten or harass a 911 operator during a 911 call, or disrupt communications between 911 operators and first responders, or between two first responders. The second part defines what emergency communication is, an emergency communication center, and what an emergency communication worker is. The next part sets that this is a crime, Class C felony, if this is something that this person has been convicted of before, or if this interference results in the death or serious injury of another person. Otherwise, it's a Class A misdemeanor. And then Section 2 just adds a section in uncodified law that this only applies to actions that have happened after the enactment of this law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Wilson, if the number four, so A4, disrupt communications between 9/11 operators and first responders or between two first responders, I understand the 9/11 part we've discussed it. I know that's an issue, but that one seems like it kind of expands it from beyond the 911 operator to like two first responders that might be at the scene talking. Is that the intent here, or is this, because when it, the way I read it, it says or between two first responders. Does, is first responders are not typically on the 911 call with you. That would be like two people, you know, you were yelling at them, you know, two policemen that were there, a fireman and policeman at the scene of something. How does that, how would that apply?
Senator Schauer, through the chair, this is Jasmine Martin for the record. I think that we should probably listen to our invited testimony, if that's all right, because they are actually the ones that have helped us with this language and asked that that part be included in here.
Mr. Chair, the, just follow up.
Follow up.
The reason I ask is because obviously we don't want unintended consequences, and that, you know, if it's good and it's tight and it makes sense regarding the 911, but what I don't want to see is if it goes to where somebody was, you know, they just get mad at them because they're yelling, they're upset about something, and the police are there and they're back and forth, and they go, we're going to slap this on you for, you know, because you were yelling at us and you were interfering between two, you know, law enforcement officers or whatever on the scene. So how that would apply legally in this case.
And so just again, through the chair, Senator Schauer, Jasmine Martin, a part of that beyond that's in the actual text of the bill, page two, the first part of page two, there is what we're looking at. It says with the intent to cause disruption in service. So there would actually have to be proof that they intended to cause a disruption in service.
Okay. I'd like to get the legal guys to talk about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follows a little bit along the lines of Senator Schauer's line of inquiry with regard to intent. We hear a lot about how a lot of our emergency first responder network, it has their time taken up by the with mental health concerns, the mentally ill, et cetera. How would, if someone who is mentally ill, not necessarily processing things correctly, is repeatedly calling 911, how do we anticipate that situation being handled?
So through the record, this is Senator Wilson. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, this is a huge problem and concern throughout our nation and our state. There's another piece of legislation working its way through the body to help address some of that concern. But right now, there is no other way. So instead of trying to refer someone to receive help, this is the only methodology that we have at our disposal right now without having a crisis center or drop-off center where police can actually help transport someone in need of a crisis or just need that assistance. So this would hopefully help someone get that assistance through our mental health courts that we have currently. But right now, all they can do is show up each time, verify that that person's not in an emergency, and then come back 5 minutes later when they call again. And they have to do that by law, and there's no other methodology. The police can't give that information to a social service agency to help come out. There's no other possibilities of that right now without having that other piece of legislation sort of passing through the body. I mean, this is a huge concern. We don't want to try to criminalize mental health, and we don't want them to spend time in DOC. But currently, we're trying to make sure that, and you'll hear from some of the testifiers, some of the stories that has happened as recently as just last year and previously about why this is a need. And we're not trying to sort of dismiss the concern of mental health within our state, but we're just trying to help get people the critical access to care without trying to disrupt other emergency situations and life-saving capabilities and those resources to be tied up on an issue that could be addressed by other methodologies.
Follow up, Senator Myers. That's good.
All right. Not currently, I'll think about it later.
Senator Hughes.
I'm just going to put this kind of out on the table, and then we might have to bring somebody from the criminal law division because we're setting something up to be a crime. And so I would, you know, when things like this happen, how difficult is it going to be for the prosecutor to work a case when we have phrases such as knowing that there is not a police, fire, or medical emergency, a phrase like with the intent to intimidate, with a phrase like with the intent to cause a disruption in service, because they have to be able to prove that. So I don't know if the sponsor wants to speak to it. I'm looking at who we have available. We have Department of Public Safety folks available. I think we might need someone that would prosecute a case like this, just so we know how that language might work and if we need something that's sharper and more specific, because we've having worked on some criminal legislation, sometimes those phrases really make a difference in how, if they can actually get something across the finish line. So maybe they're fine, but maybe at the next hearing we could have someone from the criminal law, from the Department of Law, criminal division.
And also, if I could maybe elaborate on Senator Hughes' question, is or maybe the sponsors could speak to, is, are we inventing the wheel here, or are we looking at states that have already invented the wheel and we're borrowing some of their legislation, to, you know, as far as these being tried and true phrases that are appropriate for it?
For the record, Senator Wilson, Mr. Chair, and this is working with the dispatch community with these phrases and what has happened. We're not trying to create something new. This is working with legislation that has been passed in other states and working with what they found to be effective. And so I think that, again, some of the folks that run one of the largest dispatch centers in our state will be able to speak a little bit more upon the language and sort of how the language came about and how that works.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. I didn't mean to hijack your question. Yeah. Back to Senator Hughes.
Follow up. And what I'm trying to show, like number one, it's almost like a numerical on page one, line seven, because if they make more than one call and there's been no change in circumstances, that's automatic. You know, that's really clear cut. Then you get down to two, three, and four, and we're talking about something that's a bit subjective. And so that's my only concern. I totally understand the need. I want to support our dispatchers. We're talking life safety here, really important to take care of this, and I appreciate the sponsor bringing forward. I just want to make sure we have really clear language that would be helpful to nip this in the bud if a case were brought forward. That's just the subjectivity of it is my concern. Maybe that's the best we can do it, but it's really clear cut. If somebody makes two, three, four calls and no change in circumstances, no question there. But as soon as you're talking about intent and whether somebody knows something or not, you enter this kind of fuzzy world. And so if that's just something for the next hearing, to have someone from the criminal division to answer that.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Senator Akil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsor on the four ways to get crosswise with this law. I guess three of them seem pretty clearly tailored to just what it's called, interfering, right? One and two are about tying up the line, tying up the dispatcher. Number four is directly interfering or blocking communication. Number three, I'm not sure I quite understand how it fits in a criminal law context. It's about being mean, nasty, rude, inappropriate, which none of which are okay, especially to our dispatchers. But they don't seem to be about actual interference with providing emergency communications. Can you help me with number three there?
I could through the chair, Senator Wilson. In terms of, you know, using obscene language during emergency communication and with the intent, again, to intimidate or harass, would delay or could make someone fearful of providing accurate assistance to that individual. You know, we all know what obscene language is. We all know what this, you know, entails. And again, I think that some of the, you know, folks that actually handle the dispatch calls can really talk about how this really interferes with them performing their duties. I mean, it's really something to have an officer there when you're trying to talk to somebody and having someone making harassing threats to you while trying to provide accurate assistance to provide life-saving altered information to the emergency dispatch, to the first responder. It's not helpful. It's very dangerous, and no one should have to be fearful of doing their job.
It's just a follow-up. I don't disagree with anything you said, but putting someone in fear is a separate crime. So I'll listen to the expert witnesses who are coming and try and get my head around that.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel. Senator Schauer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One last one, David. Just kind of a different path for a second, not from the people that are doing it, but from the people that are hearing it. And I don't know how else to ask this except plain English. Is there a way or any intent here or something? And they may brief us to this later, so it's a question for you or for the follow-on experts, where they can essentially blow that off. And what I mean is, you know, if they get the person, they go, it's XYZ, they do this all the time. Because I know right now you said they have to do it. That's the question, right? They got to answer everyone, send somebody out. Is there some method that we can, when we have the repeat offenders where they can without getting it, and maybe they get in trouble, maybe they don't. But I'm asking because if we're going to do this, maybe there's an option of saying, you know, we know it's the same person. We know they're going to keep calling. We don't have to, or at least protect the dispatchers from having to deal with that. Like if they say, you know what, he's called 10 times a day and I'm not taking the call again, we're not wasting our time, they're not going to get in trouble. So I don't know how you address that. Maybe you've thought about it, but I'm just curious what you do for them. Because like I said, that's part of the problem, right? They're calling over and over and over. They're tying up the lines. They're doing different things. What's the protection for the dispatchers, or has anybody even looked at that so they're not having to be at risk?
Through the chair, there is no other, there's no other law provision by statute. I don't have the statute handy. They have to answer those calls. You know, I think you'll hear someone call 86 times on Thanksgiving Day, and they have to answer 86 times. And they have, you know, spoil that cried wolf. That one time you don't call, that's when litigation and the other issues occur. And so they have to do their job professionally with consistency every single time they answer that phone call.
So, Mr. Chair, there is no provision to protect them, and that's why I asked. Maybe that's something we should investigate and make sure that they are, you know, if something was to happen like that on the 86th time, or they don't answer the 87th because of some things, maybe there should be something we do that would protect them. Or at least hold them harmless. I don't know, just something to think about.
Thanks, Senator Schauer. Senator Hughes.
I've got a different one. You know.
We will have this back to questions.
Okay, but this is important to deliberate, too. So once you set the amendments, we know what needs to be amended.
Well, I doubt we'll be setting amendments. So.
Okay, good. Well, I'll get my question answered. On page 2, an emergency, line 7, emergency communication means a communication made to an emergency communication center. I'm wondering if it should also be made from, because what you could do is you could have a person who is trying to harass, intimidate, make repeated calls to the communication center who is actually interrupting the ability of that dispatcher to make a call from the communication center to get the ambulance to the scene, to get the, you know, fire department to the scene, the police to the scene. So that's a question that we might want to consider. And then I do believe that harassing and intimidating does interrupt and interfere with emergency communication, because the purpose of emergency communications is to take care of a life safety. And if you're interrupting and interfering with that, I agree with the sponsor that that does fit under this, because it is interfering with tending to a life safety issue. But the two from, do you want to comment on that? Just
I don't have a comment.
Thank you. That's fine, Senator Hughes. Senator Myers, I'm telling you, we will have legal services back next week to discuss this bill at another location. But I'm sure this is a short question.
It'll be short. It'll be short, and it's not so much a question as a comment, but I am interested in the response. Senator Hughes brings up an interesting point that I think might be a little bit of a loophole. So, for example, if somebody calls 911, almost immediately, call gets picked up, almost immediately hangs up, dispatcher calls back, and then somebody starts using obscene language in the call back. Technically, that would be a little bit of a loophole, because that would not be a communication made to the center. And so that might be something reason to put in the from as well.
Duly noted, Senator Myers. Senator Wilson, Ms. Martin, thank you for introducing your bill. We're going to move to invited testimony. If you'd please vacate the presenter's table so we'll make room for the rest.
Mr. Chair, without offending the committee, I may have another piece of legislation up in another committee and may have to step out.
Did you care to make any final comments? I'll give you that offer right now.
I think Ms. Martin may be able to wrap anything else up.
All right. Before we set this aside, I'll ask Ms. Martin to come back up. Thank you so much. All right. Next up on the list is invited testimony. We do have Commissioner James Cockrell, Department of Public Safety, here in person in the room. Commissioner Cockrell, do you care to come up to the presenter's table? And as invited testimony, I will just give you an opportunity to present your invited testimony after you place yourself on the record.
All right. Through the chair, I'm James Cockrell, Commissioner of Department of Public Safety. I didn't expect to go first, but I do want to applaud Senator Wilson for bringing this bill forward and you guys taking the time to review this bill and potentially make it into law at some point in time. I'm just going to do a real high level because we've got some experts here, and I'm certainly not an expert in emergency communications dispatching. So I was on the other end of the radio. But as part of the Department of Public Safety, this is one of the things that, you know, I've seen and dealt with throughout my career when you go into dispatch centers with people calling in and disrupting legitimate calls. And there's got to be a tool that law enforcement can use to prevent this from happening. It not only disrupts potential responses to critical emergency situations, but it also provides a lot more stress to our over-stressed dispatchers. And so I see this as not only protecting the folks that we have to go out and respond to, but it also is a sense of protection for our emergency dispatchers. So with that said, like I said, I'll keep this really short. You know, the Department of Public Safety, Division of Alaska State Troopers support this bill and applaud your efforts for listening. Unless you have any questions, I'll leave it to the experts.
Thank you, Commissioner Cockrell.
Thank you.
With no questions, I will invite the two Butcher boys who assure me they're not related, but Jacob Butcher, the communications manager at MATCOM Dispatch, if you care to come up, and then also Joel Butcher, if you care to, APC, APCO, NINA, Alaska president in person. I'll let you go through your proper affiliation. Jacob Butcher, do you care to go first?
Sure.
Place yourself in the record,
yep,
and begin.
Jacob Butcher, communications manager for MATCOM Dispatch with the City of Wasilla. We cover 911 and dispatch responsibilities for the entirety of the Mat-Su Borough, as well as the Copper River sub-census area out to Glen Allen, Wrangell, St. Elias, all the way to Canadian border and down to Valdez. We have a PSAP boundary of about 52,000 square miles and a population in excess of 150,000 people. I've been working as a 911 emergency telecommunicator for nearly 16 years. During my time in this profession, I've answered countless emergency calls for help from members of our communities. I've been instrumental in providing emergency life-saving support, such as walking a wife through bleeding control instructions on her husband, de-escalating suicidal callers that are armed, and providing a new mother with CPR instructions on her infant child. These are the types of incidents that emergency dispatchers handle on a day-in and day-out basis and can occur at any given time of any given day, which honestly is part of the fulfilling aspect of the work that we do. It's important to understand that not every 911 call ringing into the center is a life and death emergency. Yet, as you guys understand clearly, every call must be answered and processed in an appropriate, efficient manner to determine if the actual emergency exists. Because there's no way to tell when the phone's ringing what's on the other end of the line. Those calls which are not emergent can normally be handled in stride with patience, grace, and education to redirect to non-emergency resources. However, there are some instances where explanation and education just cannot surmount the disruption caused by the intentionally false, disorderly, and harassing calls to the center. I can attest with personal experience over the July 4th weekend of 2021, most recently. Our 911 center was more or less attacked by two separate forms of this interference with emergency communications. One form was through a computerized call spoofing, which simulates false emergencies. We had a total of 45 of these false reports within a 24-hour period. Each call, however, needed to be answered, processed, and followed up on to vet and ensure that the reported incident was in fact false. These calls tied up resources from MATCOM, the Department of Public Safety, the Anchorage Police Department, Anchorage Fire Department, and several others. The second, yet simultaneous issue that we're juggling at the same time was a member of the community who was upset with the way a previous incident had been handled, and he chose to air his frustrations to us through the 911 dispatchers by dialing the emergency number over 80 times in a single day, only to unleash a barrage of profane, insulting, and extremely vulgar expressions on the telecommunicators before hanging up. Concurrently with these calls, these disrupting calls being placed, our communication center staff was left attempting to sift through those among the other barrage of emergency calls to provide actual assistance and response to a myriad of real-life emergencies, which included a reported drowning with ensuing water rescue efforts, two plane crashes, one of which involved two parents and a young child, four separate reported wildfires sparked by fireworks, and a full structure fire. most true emergencies are those where seconds count, and that's just not a sacrifice that we can afford to handle. So what I ask of this committee is to put yourself in that position where you're calling 911 for an actual emergency for a loved one that you need to provide care for, and having your call placed on hold or interrupted by one of these 120-plus false emergent 911 calls that came into our center. That's the problem that we're trying to solve here. SB 182 would provide a mechanism in which law enforcement can react swiftly to resolve these disruptions to our central public safety infrastructure. Quick resolution can free up the 911 lines, unencumber the emergency telecommunicators and responders, and expedite the resources to the members of the state with true time-sensitive emergencies. That's the extent of my prepared statement. If possible, I'd like to try to address some of the questions that have already been asked. I have some notes. First of all, Senator Schauer, you brought up the topic of interference with communication between two first responders. The situation that you posed is actual, could be legitimate. However, the opportunity of that actually being pursued as a criminal charge, I would say, would be nil. A lot of this has to do with not necessarily that we don't have thick skin as first responders, but when it gets to the point where it is out of control and there's no other option left, this would give us a fix for it. When I think about disruption between two first responders, I would think about more of an attack on the infrastructure of the communication system, whether that be taking pot shots at a radio tower, destruction of actual physical equipment and infrastructure. That would disrupt communication between two first responders in the field. Although that kind of thing might fall under more of a malicious mischief type statute, this would just give a little more muscle behind that and additional options for law enforcement to pursue. That's where my mind goes with interfering with communication between two field responders under this aspect. You also brought up a question about repeat callers. I was having trouble understanding that. If you could rephrase that.
What I think, and by the way, thanks for being here because I had a chance to tour. If you haven't toured these centers and watched what these guys do, it's pretty cool. What I was trying to get at was the other side of the equation, because we're talking about people calling in and what they do. My question is related to you guys. So, what are there anything that we can do that is either isn't happening now, or something we could put into a law like this that would give you an option or protection as the people doing the work, if you got the 80 calls on November, and you go, you know what, same guy, and you know, we're not answering it now. And I know that's why I said that you have this fine line of you got to answer every call, but is there something we can do or put in here that would give you options or protections or something that might hold you harmless? So if you got, you know what, we're tired of answering this and you're screwing up, you know, these other important calls, does that exist now? If it doesn't, is there something you guys as the expert might suggest that would help so you could have that hold harmless? I don't know what else to call it, but something along that line.
Right. I understand that now. Thank you for that. I don't know that type of mechanism is necessary in there. We do have an obligation to answer every 911 call, just because you get your 80 911 calls in a day, especially when you start dealing with the mental health aspect. That 81st 911 call could be the person harmed themselves, somebody else harmed them, they harmed somebody else, or their house caught on fire because of something they did. We have to answer that call. We have to ensure there's not an emergency. Otherwise, yes, that liability will come back on us. I don't know that it would be appropriate to remove that responsibility from 911, just due to the fact that that's the whole purpose that they're there, is to answer that call for help and send the appropriate response. So that's where it starts getting a little sticky and a little tough, where we need this mechanism in there to handle these types of situations. Our situation over July 4th weekend of last year, to speak to Senator Meyer's topic of mental health. I've been a part of the CIT Coalition for the MATSU for the last 4 years. I'm a huge proponent for mental health programs and mental health support. However, as Senator Wilson mentioned, there are some times where that is just not an option. When you're looking at a Saturday on a July 4th weekend where you have a three-day weekend and you know, all the state offices are closed, all the mental health programs are closed, what other option do you have other than to let this continue to happen over the next 3 days? And when you're looking at 84 calls in a one-day period and you're looking at two more days of that happening, there are just some instances because of our environment right now where there just is no other option. and to get that interference to stop, even just for the weekend, before we can get the other state offices and the other mental health facilities open and back in business and get them help that way. The goal here is to stop the interference when it's happening.
Thank you, Mr. Butcher. Is that I would like to also get to Joel Butcher, if possible. You have a short question.
It is related to the conversation that you're having. So this, if we pass this in both bodies, and it's not going to necessarily stop what happened on July 4th, unfortunately. It would discourage it, but that doesn't mean it still wouldn't happen. So I just want to make that clear. It still would have to be pursued, you know, by the troopers and everything. So those of us here at the table and those listening, because we know an interruption like that could actually cost the life of someone else who needs help, do you have a protocol, or do emergency communication centers have a protocol so that you can, if you have that that particular day where that you've got those 120 calls or whatever coming in, where you call in extra dispatchers and you can open up extra lines? Do you have because like I said, this law is not necessarily going to stop it. It's going to discourage it. Do you have a protocol that kicks in if you have a crazy particular day like that?
Thank you, Senator Hughes. That really would come down to a departmental policy and procedure issue. That July 4th weekend, that's actually the reason that I came in, was because we were being hit with these false reports, and the call volume was up close to 50% over our normal day-to-day call volume. So that's the whole reason that I came in to personally deal with this situation, is because of that call volume. So yes, there is the opportunity to call in additional people. However, staffing level in the first responder world is a topic, a pretty big topic this year as it is. And the short staffing issues and the burnout and the overtime rates that are already happening, that can prove extremely difficult at times.
Thank you, Mr. Butcher. I will move on to Joel Butcher. If you care to state your affiliation and put yourself on the record and begin your invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Butcher, Palmer, Alaska. I work for the City of Wasilla as a technical support specialist for MATCOM and the Dispatch Center and the police department. Certified by the National Emergency Number Association as an emergency number professional, I'm here today as president of the Alaska Joint Chapter of APCO and NENA. As chapter president, I represent approximately 150 ESDs, emergency dispatch communicators, dispatchers, and they're employed across the state in various telecommunication centers. The proposed legislation is important to our members and the telecommunication centers in the state of Alaska for several reasons. One of the most important reasons is that no one should be subject to the type of abusive language that our dispatchers receive on a regular basis. Most of the time, this abusive language is used as an intimidating factor to affect a response outside the control of the communication center. Most harming is a repetitive calling by a single party, as you've heard. This type of behavior is similar to a denial of service attack, where we tie up 911 trunk lines, preventing other callers from being able to call, and tying up human resources in the emergency communication center that would otherwise be available to receive those 911 calls. These types of events are usually the result of emotional or mental distress of the calling party, and at times the only alternative to stopping this behavior is by arrest and short-term incarceration until they can get the help that they need. The other thing that this legislation specifically criminalizes is the malicious mischief to communications infrastructure. Some people call it vandalism, but it's really the intentional destruction of public property. It's property that belongs to us. It's property that belongs to you. It's property that is intended in our communications infrastructure to communicate with responders and receive communications from responders. A lot of these sites, radio sites, whether it be antenna, generator, they're open to the public. If you drive by MATCOM, we've got a communications tower up front. You can, you know, you can do some damage with a shotgun, 12-gauge buckshot to our tower. A lot of times this infrastructure is remote, and so when it gets damaged, it takes a lot of resources to go and fix that. Finally, the legislation helps define specific criminal instances of false reporting to the communication center. These false reports are often used to generate a response as a prank, as revenge, or to cause the movement of resources away from a geographic area so crimes can be committed in a different geographic area. This is not new to Alaska. This has already occurred, and this type of activity costs time and resources, searching for parties pretending to be lost, endangers the public by affecting an emergency response when none exists, and has been a contributing factor for criminal activity. I'd like to thank Senator Wilson's office for introducing this legislation, and I urge you guys to consider it, and I'd like to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Butcher. Are there any further questions from the committee? And seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We will move on to public testimony at this time. All right, so I will open public testimony. Public testimony is now open on SB 187. Does anyone in the room care to offer public testimony? Please come up to the presenter's table and put yourself on the record with any affiliation you care to offer yourself or anyone in particular, and begin your public testimony. We'll try to keep it to about 2 or 3 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Hillary Palmer, and I'm testifying today as the Secretary Treasurer for the Alaska Chapter of APCO NENA, which is an organization of 911 professionals from across the state, but also as your constituent from MATSU. And more importantly, as someone who has relied upon emergency medical services in order to bring my type 1 diabetic spouse back to me so many times while he was enduring kidney failure and on the brink of death. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today here before you in our state's capital on behalf of Senate Bill 182, which seeks to prohibit interference with emergency communications. What does it mean to prohibit interference with emergency communications? Well, as you've already heard, occasionally someone who is experiencing an acute mental health or substance abuse crisis will call 911 repeatedly to harass or prank dispatchers. The individual may make upwards of 50 to 100 calls in a 24-hour period, and that may sometimes persist over several days before they fall asleep or find other things to do. This ties up the phone lines and requires dispatchers to place calls for actual emergencies on hold. The first question we always get asked is, so why can't we ignore those phone calls? I mean, we have caller ID, don't we? Well, in most dispatch centers, according to state and federal statutes, the 911 call takers are actually required to answer all incoming 911 calls within 3 seconds. So even if they see that caller ID and they know this is that creepy harassing person, they still have to answer that phone. You or I, as private citizens, have more rights and protections currently to enable us to stop harassment than the dispatch centers themselves, who we rely upon. Please take a moment to imagine yourself in a situation where someone you love is having a severe medical emergency and you have called 911 for help. As the dispatcher is talking you through how to provide care until first responders arrive to help, let's say they're walking you through CPR, they may sometimes need to place you on a brief hold in order to communicate with responder crews navigating to your location. But what if, in your time of need, someone who is not having an emergency decides to prank call 911 every 5 minutes for 24 hours? When seconds count and lives are at stake, we cannot afford to cater to this type of dangerous behavior. We need a way to keep this person away from their phone and in a safe place for 24 hours until they can get the mental health care that they need. We need your help so that dispatchers can do their jobs, so they can be the calm voice in your moment of chaos. Please support this bill so that Alaskans will never have to wonder if the outcome for their loved one would have been different if only our 911 professionals were free to perform to the best of their ability. Thank you.
Thank you for your public testimony, Mrs. Palmer. Does anyone else in the room care to offer public testimony? Seeing no one else in the room, I believe we have one person standing by on the phone, and I'm doing, there we go, crazy things to my tab here. Antonia Hagen in Wasilla. Antonia Hagen, if you can hear me, please state your name, any affiliation, and your location, and begin your 2 to 3 minutes of public testimony.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Just fine.
Okay, this is Antonia Hagen out here in Wasilla Fishhook, or Palma Fishhook, Matsu, currently, and I'm not really sure if this is the same subject. I mean, it's the same subject. I'm just not sure if this bill is addressing what I was, my question would be that is this bill also addressing when a perpetrator is interfering with a 911 phone call? And if there's going to be, if there's any language around that as well, I've experienced that before where I was calling 911 in an emergency domestic violence experience, and the phone was snatched from my hand as I was wrestled down to get the phone. And yeah, so it was a really horrendous experience, and it backfired on me. And I'm just wondering if, you know, like there's records that, you know, phone calls are made first by a certain victim, and if that kind of, if that goes in the language, or if this is just completely on people that are really attacking the system. And that's really all I guess it's a question, and I wanted to share a little bit of my testimony, because put yourself in the situation of, you know, being a mother with a little child and having a phone taken out of your hand when you've called 911, and then the police come and take you away, and your child goes with the violent father, and yeah, it's a pretty scary situation. So I just want to make sure that all Alaskans are safe from that type of behavior as well. And yeah, that's all I had to share. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Hagen, thank you so much for providing public testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing no one else waiting online and no one else in the room, I'm going to close public testimony at this point. All right, I'll just, I don't know if we are preparing to set this aside. I see Senator Wilson still in the room. Senator Wilson, would you care to come up, maybe address the question? I don't. Please address the last.
Thank you.
And then offer any closing comments you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, this is for the record. This is Senator David Wilson. Yes, that's already a crime. Interfering with a domestic violence call or impairing someone from making a 911 call. That's already on the statutes, and it's already on the books. I've worked in that field for over 6 years, and that is definitely a crime. And I would like to thank the committee again for hearing this piece of legislation. And again, we're just trying to give the tools for law enforcement officers to intervene in the situation. We understand that it may not, you know, these folks that are making these calls probably won't be reading the statutes or reading the regs, but this will hopefully give the tools to intervene to stop those calls from continuing and happening. Our purpose is here is to give the tools necessary for our emergency communications operators to perform their duties to the best level of their capability without being hindered by these types of harassing situations. And just want to say thank you, and we look forward to continuing this conversation.
All right. Thank you, Senator Wilson. I do believe we still have some questions outstanding, and we'll have legal services back to bounce questions off of at a future next week. But at this time, we'll set Senate Bill 182 aside. Next on the agenda is Senate Bill 7, back before the committee. It's related to publishing state trooper policies. I'll welcome Senator Elvie Gray Jackson to the presenter's table and any staff she may require. This bill was previously heard on May 10th, 2021. Senator Gray Jackson, would you care to remind us, it's been a while, what Senate Bill 7 does?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Senator Elvie Gray Jackson and my staff, Keith Bogus. And first, I want to thank the committee for hearing the bill. And my staff will tell you, whenever they tell me that any of my bills are going to be before a committee for a hearing, I almost feel like I won an Academy Award. truly. So thank you. This bill would basically require DPS to publish on their website the department's current policies and procedures that are related to the conduct of peace officers employed or regulated by the department. And it's the duty of the public safety, Department of Public Safety, to ensure public safety within our communities. And as such, the public must be able to easily access the current policies and procedures. And I am aware that the Department of Public Safety is currently publishing policies and procedures, but this bill will require that happen, even if administrations change, commissioners change, and that's the reason why I brought it forward. And I don't think there's any need to read the one sentence explanation, so unless you want to hear it. But with that said,
I believe, did we handle that last time?
Yeah, we did. We handled that last time. Yeah.
Any questions for the sponsor at this time? We will open public testimony on Senate Bill 7. So public testimony is open for Senate Bill 7. Does anyone in the room care to offer public testimony? And seeing no one, I'll look online. I don't see anyone online wishing to offer public testimony on Senate Bill 7. So we'll close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed on Senate Bill 7. We have a few amendments to consider, I believe we have Captain David Wilson online, no relation to Senator David Wilson, I guess, even though they both live in the Valley. But Captain David Wilson, first of all, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
All right, so there was an amendment under consideration, and the understanding is that the department doesn't approve municipal policing policies and procedures, and only indirectly regulates non-state trooper officers correctly? Correct? I'm sorry. Did you even understand that? Do I need to restate that?
I just wanted to speak that I had made myself available for questions at the request of the commissioner, and that might be a better question for him if Commissioner Cockrell is in the room.
Did Senator Jackson, would y'all care to...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you're referencing non-employees of the Department of Public Safety.
Yeah, the question was there's a phrase inside there about regulating, what kind of officers they may regulate. And it may be to let Commissioner Cockrell come back to the presenter's table.
Thank you. I'll back off.
Okay, so, and my question for the commissioner would be, so the department does not approve municipal policing policies and procedures and only indirectly regulates those officers.
Through the chair, this is James Cockrell, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And to answer your question, I think what you're referring to is, you're correct. We do not regulate any municipal police department in this state. We do not have that authority. We do, I think this is addressed in the VPSO program. That's the only agency, I think, that we would outwardly. We don't, essentially they're not Department of Public Safety employees, but we do have a partnership with the VPSO program.
All right. So, and the concern was that the word or regulated, the words are regulated in this bill, it would still only apply to Alaska State Troopers or VPSO.
Through the chair, I guess my recommendation would be just put the VPSO and delete the word regulated. And that would, I think, clear up any misconceptions we might have or have in the future.
All right. And so let's see.
I have a question along that line.
Senator Hughes.
Just for clarification, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you only had employed, it would only apply to troopers then, right? So if we want it to apply also to VPSAs, VPSOs, we'd need the or regulated, is that correct?
I guess I just want to make sure that we're clear on where we're going to go here. First of all, as she said, the Department of Public Safety publishes all our policies online and have for several years. We also manage the VPSO program. They have an SOP with our department that is signed by all the grantees. And to my knowledge, currently they are not published. So essentially they are following our OPM, if you want to call it that. So if you want us to publish their SOPs is what it looks like, I think you should put it in the bill. And I do have a little bit of concern with it because we manage 10 grantees that all have potentially could go their own directions in their in the way they operate their VPSOs. Currently, we have a joint agreement with them based on the current SOP that they follow, but doesn't mean they have to follow that. They could go on their own if they wanted. And so that's my biggest concern in regard. I know I'm probably confusing, but with the VPSO program. The bottom line is the department supports publishing our OPM, our policies and procedures. There should not be any secret between us and our public and our citizens. And I want to make that clear. We support that part of the bill. I just want to know where we want to – I don't understand what the sponsor wants us to do by regulate it. If they want us to publish the VPSO policies and procedures, we will do that, and I think it should be in the bill.
I believe my capable staff, Ed King, has brought Kelly Howell to the presenter's table for do you have input on this particular point?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm the special assistant to the commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. No more to add really than what the commissioner has already said. The department does regulate the village public safety officer, but does not regulate any other department. So I believe what, not to put words in his mouth, but I believe what the commissioner is referring to is perhaps to add clarity and avoid any confusion that the department does regulate other agencies or organizations outside of the Village Public Safety Officer Program, that the bill clearly state the Village Public Safety Officer Program. Either that or eliminate the or regulated language altogether if the intent is not to also publish the Village Public Safety Officer policies and procedures online.
Thank you, Ms. Howell. My original thought was to delete the words or regulated from it's kind of put a little bit of a complication because now it might it may be a little bit more than just that simple amendment. At this point, I am not going to offer amendment A.1 at this moment. We'll move on to amendment A.2. I move amendment A.2.
Object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Amendment A.2 seeks to ensure that the requirement to publish policies and procedures in this bill maintains the exceptions in the Alaska Public Records Act. This amendment restates those law enforcement exceptions found in AS40.25.120 and makes it clear that they still apply if this bill were to become law. Senator Schauer, do you maintain your objection?
Mr. Chairman, could we maybe have some of our experts just comment to that as well as far as what impacts it may have?
Sounds good. It's your objection. So, Commissioner Cockrell?
Through the chair, I've reviewed your amendments and the department's fine with them.
All right. Ms. Howell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Kelly Howell, for the record. We agree that adding the exceptions that are currently under Alaska Statute 4025120, which is the Public Records Act, the exceptions regarding information that is law enforcement sensitive, currently prohibited from public release under the Public Records Act, should be added to the bill to, again, add clarity that the department should not be permitted to post those online to release any kind of, you know, confidential or sensitive information regarding law enforcement procedures or policies. So we do support the amendment. Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Schauer.
I will, based on that discussion, I will remove my objection, but I would like it for the record. We've discussed this based on my background. I understand at times there is a need to hide things because transparency, as the sponsor is doing, is very important. You're right, Commissioner. People need to have trust. But there is a time that you would have to suppress things for some amount of time while it's going on, and we certainly don't want people to look at what a certain team might do that would put them at risk. I know the sponsor, we've talked about it in a previous committee, is not intending to do that. So I appreciate this, Mr. Chair. I think this works. If I see no other objections to it, I will remove my objection.
But I guess I'll object for further discussion because I see Senator Myers and maybe even Senator Keel's got a question there, and that's okay. It's my objection now. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you hadn't, I was going to object simply to ask that we get a quick comment from the bill sponsor.
All right. The bill sponsor. I'm sorry, I didn't see you there. Senator Gray Jackson. Senator Ray Jackson, welcome back to the presenter's table. Do you have any comment?
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Senator Myers. I have no issue with the bill whatsoever. But if I may, can I comment on the regulator, the other comments that were made in terms of the VPSO? I have no issue whatsoever deleting and regulate it and adding VPSO because that was the intent of the bill from the very beginning. So I'm fine with that.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Senator. Thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Keel, do you still have a question?
That's what I was going to ask, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Keel. This point, I will remove my objection to that amendment. And without objection, amendment A.2 is adopted. At this point, a brief at ease. Senate Judiciary Committee is back on the record. Sorry for that brief interruption. So having moved Amendment A.2, are there any amendments from the committee members?
At ease, please.
A brief at ease. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. So do members have any further amendments?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hughes.
I move conceptual amendment number one.
I will object for explanation.
And this is based on A.1. And so what we would do, I move an amendment. That's right.
Brief at ease. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Senator Hughes, would you please state your conceptual amendment? We'll call conceptual amendment number one.
Yes, I will do that, Mr. Chair. So conceptual amendment number one would, on page one, line seven, delete the words or regulated and insert the words village public safety officer program.
Thank you for that, for stating that. At this point, I will object for discussion. Is there any discussion on the proposed conceptual amendment? I think we've had enough input from the sponsor and invited testimony. So I will withdraw my objection. Is there any further objection to conceptual amendment number one? Seeing brief at ease. Senate Judiciary, sorry all this popping the break, but Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Looks like conceptual amendment one has been adopted by the committee, and the committee gives authority to legal services for conforming and technical changes to the conceptual amendment number one. At this time, are there any more amendments to SB 7? Seeing none offered. Are there any more questions from the sponsor? Seeing none, Senator Gray Jackson, do you have any closing remarks while you're here?
Again, I just want to say thank you very much to the chair and the committee for hearing my bill. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Jackson. With no other comments, no other amendments, I will look to the will of the committee.
I'm ready, Mr. Chairman.
All right. What is the will of the committee, Senator Schauer?
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate Bill 7, Work Order 32-LS00584-Alpha, as amended, be reported from the Senate Judiciary Committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
So without objection, Senate Bill 7 has been reported from the committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. There will be a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Senate Judiciary is back on the record. Maybe the last brief at ease for the day. I don't know. We still got a lot of talking to do. So Senate Bill 31 is back before the committee relating to binding caucuses. This is the fourth hearing on Senate Bill 31 in Senate Judiciary. It's previously heard on May 10th, 2021, and on February 2nd and February 11th, 2022. We do have Noah Klein on the phone from Legal Services. So let me jump on this real quick. All right. Senator Schauer, quickly, do you want to give us a brief synopsis on Senate Bill 31?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Make it quick because we've talked about it before. Plenty of people have heard me talk about this for years. All this really does, or the attempt is to put down on and codify into law that a legislator or legislators, as they form caucuses, groups that, you know, majority, minority, Senate, you know, House, et cetera, cannot bind another legislator moving forward to vote for something in the future and have the threat of coercion against them for not voting in a certain way, because that's something we've seen. We've discussed it previously, so I won't go down that, but I would like to read one thing because it came up in the last meeting, and I had to pull it from memory, so if I may read, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed, Senator Schauer.
Thank you. So if you go to Alaska Statutes, Title 11, Criminal Law 1141-530, coercion, it's one of the ways we started this with basically bribery and coercion, and people freak out when they hear it, oh, my God, and the felony and that kind of stuff, but you can see where we put this in for a reason so that people will think about the seriousness of it and then looking at it as we did with ethics laws and something else to at least have something if it was to happen, which it has, and currently there is nothing that a legislator can really do about it. They're pretty much just left in the dark, as we've discovered, ethics or anything else. This is how it reads. A person commits the crime of coercion if the person compels another to engage in conduct from which there is a legal right to abstain, or abstain from conduct in which there is a legal right to engage, by means of instilling in the person who is compelled a fear that, if the demand is not complied with, the person who makes the demand or another may, and this is down to number four, take or withhold action as a public servant, or cause a public servant to take or withhold action. As I have said before, I do not know how it could be any more crystal clear in the examples we have highlighted before in the past where those very things have happened in this building, and there appears to be absolutely no consequence whatsoever for that kind of action. And yet it happens here on a fairly regular basis, depending on who's in charge. So that is the point, Mr. Chair. I wanted to read that so it comes right out of the statutes. We downgraded this over several years of looking at it and through amendments to get us to a place that does not cause such fear or consternation, because as Senator Keel had asked before, it was a good question. There is no intent here to have people running around about every bill they do. This was primarily about how we form those caucuses and what agreements are made, and then how that is held over a legislator's head, that they will vote a certain way or not and be punished. It's happened. This is clear, right out of our own statutes. I want something, I believe, that would keep us from seeing that happen in the future, or at least legislators know, shoot, if I do this, I could be held accountable. And ultimately, it's about accountability. That I just wanted to add that to the discussion for the record, Mr. Chairman. If there's no amendments or anything else, whatever we want to do is fine. I just wanted to get that out there. Thank you.
All right. We do have Noah Klein standing by from Legislative Legal Services. And so, Mr. Klein, first of all, just give me a quick yes or no. Can you hear me? Are you out there?
For the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services. I hear you, Chair.
Thank you so much. So I have one or two questions. First, the sponsor's stated intent is to prevent a situation in which a legislator is obligated to vote for or against a motion under threat of losing staff, funding, chairmanships, committee assignments, or support for personal legislation. And does the bill as drafted meet that intent?
Again, for the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, to the chair. Yes, the bill as drafted could meet that intent, right? The bill is basically making this a certain conduct prohibited and putting it in the Ethics Act. And so if someone complained about that kind of conduct, and if the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics found that one legislator was being bound by another legislator through those threats, then the Select Committee could find an ethics violation.
Thank you. A second question I have, I believe Senator Hughes proposed, and it's regarding how the bill would determine who is guilty of an ethics violation under a binding caucus. For instance, under the bill, would it be majority leadership, or would it be an individual negotiating on behalf of the majority, or the members of the majority caucus in general, or the individual legislator who's being, I call them the bindee. You got the bindor and the bindee. But do you have any input on that?
Again, for the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, to the chair. You know, it's going to depend on the facts of how a complaint comes into the committee and what the committee is actually looking at. My understanding is generally the committee would be looking at a single legislator's conduct at a time. And so whether that legislator was in the majority leadership or leadership of any caucus, or whether it was a member joining a caucus, or whether it was the, as you put it, the bindee, I think depending on the circumstances, the committee could find any of those individual legislators to violate the Ethics Act, depending on whether they are, quote unquote, committing or being bound to commit under this act.
That was two of my questions. Are there any other questions?
Just a comment to your question and Noah's answer, and then
Senator Schauer.
Thank you. What he says makes perfect sense to me and how it lines up, because we went through this and I've seen the ethics trail. Part of why we gave up on trying to do this the right way inside the system was because in the ethics law as it stands, and what we saw as we went down that path to investigate that, we were told there's essentially nothing to see here because there was nothing that prevented it from happening. So that behavior that we went through, and we had the, I've never heard those terms, bindee and binder, we made it some new ones, I like
I'm
them.
I'm an inventor.
You're an inventor. Would have been helpful, because as I discussed this with various experts, they said, well, look, there's nothing on the books, so there's nothing that can be done about what happened to you guys. There's more than one. So his answer lines up with what we discovered through that because there was nothing on the books, there's nothing that could be done. If there was something on the books, you might have recourse to prevent that action, because people would then know if they did that, an individual or even a group of individuals, whether they were leadership or not, would then be potentially on the hook for that conflict or that action. And then ethics could do something. So it does make sense with the intent of what we were looking at, and I appreciate that Noah is basically answering that question.
Going back to Senator Schauer, to the sponsor for intent, and I was curious, it might improve the focus on the intent of the bill if we replace the words a bill, appointment, veto, or the measure with the words a procedural vote or budget bill.
I concur.
I just wanted to offer that to you. But Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Mr. Klein while he's on the line there. I was hoping we could get just a real quick synopsis of the potential consequences for an ethics violation, which is what I gather this would be then.
Mr. Klein?
Again, for the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Senator Myers. So AS 2460-178B has a list of potential sanctions that the Ethics Committee could recommend. If you'd like, I can read the list. If not, I can give you a general synopsis of what kind of things are in there.
A general synopsis would be great, Mr. Klein.
So, for example, B1 is a civil penalty of not more than $5,000 for each offense. B10, any other appropriate measure. And the most severe, I think, would be expulsion from the House of the legislature. And then just to give a little explanation of how that would work, the sanctions are recommended by the committee, and let's say we're in the Senate, this is Senate Judiciary, the recommendation would go to the Senate president, and then the body would be able to vote, and any sanction would require a majority vote, except for expulsion, which requires a two-thirds vote.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Any follow-up?
Good, thank you.
Senator Keel, I saw you had previously, and I'm I'm not sure how accurately this is going to be your question. Could the bill be interpreted to mean the minority members must have the same resources as majority members? Do you remember that question?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Is there a better resolution, a finer dot you can put at the end of that question for us?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my understanding from the sponsor's stated intent and Mr. Klein's answers would be yes. It would be a violation of the ethics law if somebody said, listen, if you don't accept our offer to join the caucus, you'll get the standard minority allocation of two staffers and 36 range points, whereas our majority offices get three staffers and 57 range points, higher average pay per staff and more staff. That sounds like pretty clear a violation of this ethics law to me.
All right. Thank you, Senator Keel.
Mr. Chair, may I have
A sponsor, I'll Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Senator Keel and I have discussed this, and he knows my stance on that because I don't think how we do it is necessarily fair or right, but that's, again, for another day. The one part I wanted to add to that is that the intent for this specifically, because this is a question that comes up about joining a caucus, forming it, don't people have a free right of association? Of course they do. That's never particularly been the issue here. The issue has been coercing a legislator to vote a certain way or withhold something from them for not voting the way they're told to vote. Both ways that goes, and that's because we have experienced that. And so that's the reason why I'm reading the statute, to make it crystal clear. If a citizen does this to a legislator, it's a crime. It is a go-to-jail offense. But in this building, you can coerce people all the time on these particular topics, the budget or procedural votes, used as political weapons. We have seen it, and there is absolutely nothing to be done about it. That's not acceptable. There's other issues here that I also agree with, and I'm happy to go however we might want to play that out in the committee, but I think it's important that's really what I'm digging at the end of the day. Your vote is your vote. Nobody should ever be allowed to coerce you to vote a certain way, and there's a reason for that. And we don't have to get into that should almost go without saying, but it happens. So how do we stop it? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I want to go back to Mr. Klein, and you gave the example of the consequences in response to Senator Meyer's question, and you kind of mentioned the $5,000 fine, and then you mentioned to the most extreme expulsion at a two-thirds vote, and then you mentioned other sanctions would take a majority vote. And so it's a two-part question. Do those majority votes have to be on the floor, or can the Legislative Ethics Committee impose sanctions with a majority vote? And then could you give us examples of sanctions? Because I'm trying to remember over time. I've heard things so simple as somebody has to write a letter of apology. I know it can be step it up, like where someone's removed from committee assignments, that kind of thing. So let us know whether that can be voted on in the committee itself, or if it has to be on the floor of the body of which the legislator is a member. And then some examples, because a letter of apology would be pretty light. And so I just want to understand what those other kind of sanctions are, in the range of those, as far as that just require a majority vote.
Mr. Klein?
Again, for the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Senator Hughes. Let me just read the list, if you don't mind, of sanctions. I think that will be helpful. So again, the civil penalty, divestiture of specified assets or withdrawal from specified association, additional disclosure, this is restitution of property or reimbursement of improperly received benefits, public or private written reprimand, censure, placing the person on probationary status, and again, expulsion. And again, the final recommended sanction could be any other appropriate measure. So the committee has some leeway there. And then your first question, Senator Hughes, was who is the majority? It is the majority of the House, or the majority of the Senate in this case.
Thank you.
Can I ask Mr. Klein one question, and I'm done? I
just have we've got 12 more minutes. Senator Schauer.
Thank you. Noah, I have a quick question for you that would relate to your answers on how this might apply using your legal mind. if, and I'm using real examples, and that's why I want to throw these out for how they would play out with this if it was to be enacted into law. If a, say, a Senate president or anybody, but let's say a Senate president told a sitting legislator that they were being punished for their speech, if a rules chair told a sitting senator that they were being punished for their vote, how does that fall in the legal sense, when you can both go statutory and ethics law, how would that potentially be? Would you agree that those would be coercive elements to a legislator for voting a certain way or not voting a certain way? And would they fall under statutory? Where would it fall under that in that case? And then in the ethics law, if it's written this way, how would those statements be handled, in your opinion?
Again, for the record, this is Noah Fine, Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Senator Schauer. You know, at the end of the day, if this is enacted, it's going to be the province of the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics in terms of how they apply this to specific instances. And so I don't know that I have any opinion on whether or not any specific conduct would be binding, or any described conduct would be binding another legislator and therefore be an ethics violation. Whether or not those could be described as coercive, I think yes, in the common parlance understanding of the word coercive, sure, threatening action against someone could make them feel in a certain way. But again, it would, I think it would depend on the specific facts that the that were in the complaint that was driving in any ethics investigation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to hear the yes, that those could be coercive factors. That's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Schauer. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been a little bit late here to the conversation, but I've been thinking a little bit about Senator Keel's comments and trying to draw that fine dividing line between organizing and coercing and things like that. And I'm reminded a little bit of a conversation that happened in this building about 15 years ago or so in the wake of the BECO scandal. And talking about, going back to the original point, talking about bribery from the outside. And I'm just remembering a point that was made in a committee that was discussing this. If I walk up to a candidate for office and I say, I'd like to give you some money because I appreciate your stance on this particular issue. Perfectly legal, perfectly ethical, nobody has any problems with it. If I walk up to a candidate for office and say, here's a check. I want you to vote a particular way. Then that starts to get a little bit more mushy and potentially getting into the bribery type situation, depending on the exact arrangement. And I would agree that we're looking at something of a similar fine line here as well. Hey, we agree with you. We've got some similar philosophical goals. So as a result, we're going to make you a chair of a committee, and this is, we're going to have you join our majority, or maybe we don't agree with you, so you're not going to join our majority. On the other side of it, it's you did something to make us mad, so we're yanking your committee chairmanship. Versus, hey, we've got a serious philosophical issue here. You're not following the same goals that we have. We're yanking your committee chairmanship. It's a bit of a fine line. I don't know if we can come up with clear-cut language along those lines, to be honest. So a lot of it, some of this could end up being left for judgment for the Ethics Committee moving forward. And that may be the best that we can ask for, but I do agree with the intent of the bill and the intent of the sponsor in trying to draw at least something of a distinction and saying, hey, we have some behavior here that's significantly questionable and we need to be able to put it on record and be able to have some consequences.
Thank you, Senator Myers. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I know Noah said that any of these sanctions have to go to the floor for the vote, but my recollection is that Legislative Ethics Committee does have the ability to impose a requirement such as writing a letter of apology, and those kind of things have not gone to the floor. So I don't know if Noah wants to comment on that again or if we can maybe get that clarified later. I don't think we have anybody online that can answer that. Jerry Anderson isn't online, but could we ask Noah if he's sure about that? Because I'm quite sure, as I've watched over the years different situations, the Ethics Committee has imposed certain things that the person involved has to do because they've determined they did violate the law, ethics law.
Mr. Klein, if you have any input on really anything. I believe Senator Myers has made some comments about Senator Keel's recent comments, or Senator Hughes' current question. Do you have any thoughts on any of those topics that you care to offer?
Again, for the record, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services. To Senator Hughes, I can do some additional research into the situations you're describing. I am not aware of any, and maybe that is a better question for ethics staff, but I can get back to the committee with an answer on that question.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, I will set an amendment deadline for Tuesday, February 22nd, on this bill. And at this time, I'll set Senate Bill 31 aside. Is there any other business before the committee? Seeing none, our next meeting is Wednesday, February 23rd at 1:30 p.m. We will be adjourned today at 2:54 p.m.